When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Between the shadows of reality and the fringe of our own fears lurks a world of monsters. Strange creatures and frightening phantoms who test the very boundaries of our science and superstition. It's a realm of mystery and legend, a place of fact and fear. This is Monstro Bizarro. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Lyle Blackburn. This episode is going to follow a bit different format. No intro, lead-in, or spooky sound effects before my greeting. That's because the story here originates from a rather long letter, which is essentially a story unto itself. The letter provides the only known details about an alleged aggressive Bigfoot case known as the Cowman of Copalis Beach. Copalis Beach is located on the western shores of Washington State, about halfway between Oregon to the south and Canada to the north, and just south of the Olympic National Forest. Some of you may have heard of this story since it's been on the internet for a while and covered by a few other shows, but in this case, I feel like I can provide some excellent context surrounding its origin and its plausibility. You might be asking why it's not called the Bigfoot of Copalis Beach, but you'll soon learn why the creature is known as the Cowman. The facts surrounding the Cowman of Copalis Beach, if they are facts, comes from an individual who identified himself as Shannon D. Baker. Some years ago, Mr. Baker submitted the account, more than 6,000 words long, to the long-running website Bigfoot Encounters. The website contains one of the best databases for historical Bigfoot information, including articles and sighting reports, so it's a reliable source. The site is one of the oldest internet resources on the subject of Bigfoot, founded back in 1995 by Bobby Short, a woman who has done so much for the preservation of Bigfoot history. Bobby, whose birth name was Roberta Lou Eardley, was born in California in 1936 and died in 2013 at the age of 76. Her interest in the subject was sparked by a dramatic incident in which she saw a 7-foot-tall Bigfoot pass directly in front of her while backpacking with friends deep in the Humboldt Forest region of Northern California on September 8, 1985. Since that day, she dedicated much of her time to the research of Bigfoot, eventually founding the website. The story here isn't about Bobby, but I just wanted to provide some context about where the story of the Cowman of Copalis Beach was first published. I'm not sure if Bobby followed up with Mr. Baker regarding the details, but given the story you are about to hear, I would imagine she would have, just to verify that it was legitimate, as best she could. The website doesn't specify when Mr. Baker sent the details to Bobby, but it's been on the site for as long as I can remember. Mr. Baker's email address is published at the end of the story. Of course, I tried emailing him at that address, but it's no longer working, nor have I been able to track him down using any other method. I wouldn't normally just read something this long word for word if I didn't write it myself, but in this case, it's been on the internet for anyone to read for many years, and there's no way to discuss the case without first presenting the letter. It's very well written, so I will let Mr. Baker's own words remain in their complete form. After after presenting the letter, I will provide some interesting details for you, some that have likely never been mentioned in connection to the topic. So sit back with your favorite beverage or curl up by the campfire and enjoy the story. Again, this is the complete letter as posted on the Bigfoot Encounters website, word for word. My dad worked in the timber industry his whole life. His father was a logger and he grew up in and around the woods. My dad started his own logging company when he was 18 and has owned and operated shake and shingle mills from Oregon clear up to Thorne Bay, Alaska. He is an intelligent man and holds over a dozen patents for various pieces of equipment he has designed and built over the years. He has employed dozens of people over the years, all of them spending extensive time in the wilderness. When I was a boy, I remember hearing bits and pieces of conversations among some of the men at the mill. Although nobody would tell me directly, I understood that something had gone on before I was born, and it involved one of the foremen, John. They weren't joking around. They were genuinely afraid and wouldn't talk about it with a kid. When I was young, my dad wouldn't tell me about it because I would often go out into the woods cutting blocks with him on the weekends, and he didn't want me to be afraid of the woods. While I was speaking with him last weekend, I told him a couple of strange events that happened to me later in the wilderness, and that reminded me of the hints at a story I had heard when I was a boy. After some prodding, he told me the following story. In the mid-1960s, my dad owned a large roofing product mill in Aberdeen, Washington. He had teams of men that would cut the fallen old-growth cedar salvage left after a logging operation. He had permits to salvage a large amount of wood in the coastal areas of Grays Harbor County, primarily in the area around Copalis Beach. Several of the men on his cutting crews lived in and around Copalis Beach. His foreman, a man I will call John for the story, was a bright, down-to-earth, hard worker. My dad trusted him with thousands of dollars of vehicles and equipment, as well as the safety of his crews. He was not the kind of man to make up stories. On a Monday morning, sometime in July, John was several hours late for work. This was highly unusual, as he was always there early, getting the saws and trucks ready for the day. My dad said he was visibly shaken up, and when he asked him what was wrong, he asked my dad to go into the office so the others wouldn't hear him. They went in and sat down, and John simply said, "Something destroyed our house this weekend." My dad thought he said someone broke into the house and asked John if it was somebody he knew. John said, "You don't understand. This wasn't a person. It was a... I don't know what it was, but it completely trashed the house. The family is going to stay with my brother and Elma for a while." My dad asked him to explain what had happened. John said that when he got home from work Friday evening, his youngest son Tim, who was around 4 at the time, told him he saw a big, quote, cowman walking at the edge of their field that afternoon. He thought the boy meant cowboy because some of his neighbors wore cowboy hats when they were out in the sun. He asked him if the man was wearing a cowboy hat, and the boy said, "No, Daddy, he was a cowman. Furry and stinky like the cows." He asked his wife if she knew what he was talking about, and she said Tim was playing on the porch that afternoon when he came running in and said the cowman was stuck on the fence. He was very excited, so she went out to see what he was talking about. She said as she opened the door, she was hit by a horrible smell, like wet dogs and garbage. Tim was pointing across the field opposite their house and said, "He got loose." She looked where he was gesturing and could see the top strand of barbed wire bouncing up and down, as if somebody had just pulled up on it really hard and let it go. She didn't see the, quote, cowman, and noticed nothing out of the ordinary except for the smell. She told Tim to come inside and play for the rest of the day. She felt uneasy and a little scared. Their older son, John Jr., who was 12 at the time, was at a friend's house and walked home a short while after Tim saw his cowman. He told her somebody had followed him home, walking in the woods off to the right side of the road. He never seen who it was. They never left the woods, but he said it had to be a really big man. He would hear large sticks cracking, and the footsteps were heavy. Once he got to the driveway of their house, where the woods stopped at the field where his brother had had his sighting, the footsteps stopped, and John Jr. never saw anything. He was pretty shaken up by the event and wanted his dad to go out into the woods and check it out with him. Later that evening, John strapped on his .357 and took his older son out into the field to have a look. They first walked to the area where the cowman was supposedly stuck on the fence and walked down the fence line looking for anything. They came upon a large clump of long reddish-brown hair tangled in the top strand of barbed wire. He tried to pull it off, but it was really tangled up, so he pulled out his buck knife and sawed it off. He said the hair was over a foot long, real coarse and stringy. There appeared to be a bit of flesh matted in the clump, and the top wire was pulled loose from one of the posts. Whatever was hung up on the fence was very big. He handed the hair to his son to hold, and they climbed through the fence and walked towards the woods. He said he was looking for any sign of tracks on the ground. The hair kind of looked like it was from a horse's mane or tail. The ground was a solid grassy field, and there were no hoof prints or any other tracks he could see. The edge of the woods began about 10 feet from the fence line, and they entered on a small game trail that deer frequented. It was around 8 at night, and in the woods it was getting to be fairly dark. They walked for a ways, and soon began to smell the rotting garbage-slash-wet dog odor his wife reported earlier. John said he got the feeling they were being watched. The hair on the back of his neck was standing up. He told his son they should head back before it got dark, and the boy didn't argue. As they began walking back out, they could hear heavy footsteps off to their left. They stopped, and the footsteps stopped. They walked on nearly to the clearing, and John whispered to his son, "Run like hell to the house on the count of three." John Jr. nodded, and John whispered, "One, two, three," and gave his son a push in the back to get him started, then spun around and raced off the trail in the opposite direction toward the footsteps with his gun drawn. Off the trail, the underbrush was dense with ferns and bushes. He had a hard time making headway, but as he got closer, he could hear it moving away from him, deeper into the woods. At this time, he told my dad that he thought it was a vagrant camping out in the woods and possibly scoping out houses to rob at night. John was a big man and capable of taking care of himself in most any situation, and he had a large caliber handgun, so he wasn't too worried about confronting a vagrant in the woods. He was a few yards off the trail in deep brush when he heard the movement stop just ahead of him. He stopped to look and listen, and thought he saw a movement by a large tree, like someone was trying to hide there. He leveled his gun and said, "Come out nice and slow, or I swear to God I'll come back there and shoot you." It was silent for a moment, and then he caught movement out of the corner of his eye and spun around to his right for a better look. He said it looked like a huge bear moving through the brush. He could only see bits of it through the dense ferns, but it was moving quietly away from the tree on four legs. It was about 15 feet away from him. At first, he thought it was a bear, and then suddenly he saw a huge, hairy arm with a human-like hand reach out of the brush and grab a small alder tree. The tree was about 4 inches in diameter, and it grabbed a hold about 5 feet up. He said it happened so fast it was a blur, but the thing pulled itself upright out of the brush by holding the tree. It stood on two legs and turned its upper body to glare at John. It was enormous. He couldn't believe how bulky it was. He said it was well over 7 feet tall, and at least half that big through the chest. It was too dark to make out many features, but its eyes seemed to glow a deep red, and he thought he could see teeth, like it was curling its lips back. It stood for just a brief moment, and then lunged ahead, pushing back on the tree with tremendous force. The tree snapped loudly and crashed into the trees around it, getting hung up in the branches and not falling to the ground. It then disappeared into the deep brush with a frightening speed, sounding like a bulldozer with no engine sounds. John stood there in shock, his gun temporarily forgotten, and then he realized it was heading towards the house, the way his son had went. He turned and ran to the trail, hoping to gain ground on it and cut it off before it reached the clearing. He hit the trail and ran as fast as he could towards the clearing, all the while hearing the creature thrash through the brush on his side. He burst into the clearing and looked frantically about for his son. John Jr. was standing just inside of the fenced field, waiting for his dad. John screamed at him to run to the house. Then he saw the thing crash out of the woods about 50 feet to his left. It crossed the 10-foot clearing and stepped over the fence in two strides and was running through the field parallel to his son in a matter of seconds. John screamed at his son to run faster and took aim at the creature. He didn't fire because he was afraid to hit his son or his house, so he vaulted over the fence and ran in pursuit of them. He could see it angling towards his son, and he knew there was no way his boy was going to make it to the gate before it cut him off. In desperation, he pointed the gun to the ground at his side and fired as he ran, hoping to scare it. It veered more sharply towards his son and put on an enormous burst of speed. He heard his boy scream as they seemed to collide. He saw the creature dip its shoulder down a little bit, and suddenly John Jr. was airborne. He flew about 10 feet, then hit the ground rolling. The creature never paused. It continued to run at an amazing speed in a loop back towards the woods. Once the line of fire was clear, John stopped and squeezed off the remaining 5 rounds at the retreating creature. He was pretty sure all the shots went wild. The creature never made a sound or slowed down, and was soon over the fence and back in the woods. He reached his son, who was shaken up but not physically hurt. He asked his dad if it was a bear. Apparently, little John was so busy running for the house that he didn't see the creature running after him. He said something big and black suddenly ran into him, and he felt a huge paw hit his bottom, and he said he felt like he was falling. John pulled his son to his feet, and they ran through the gate and into the house, locking the door behind him. They were both out of breath and white as ghosts. His wife was screaming at him, demanding to know what the gunshots were for and if they were all right. When he could catch his breath, he told her to make sure the back door was locked and he was going to call the sheriff. He went to the phone and began to dial the number. This was before 911. Then stopped and wondered what exactly he was going to say. He hung up the phone, realizing what an idiot he would look like if he told the sheriff the boogeyman just chased them out of the woods. He told his wife it was a large animal, possibly a bear. He didn't know how to begin to tell their 4-year-old he was right. His cowman was real, and it was more frightening than anything he could imagine. He told them all to keep the doors locked and stay away from the windows.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Around 10 o'clock that night, both boys were in bed and John and his wife sat down to watch the news. They soon heard a loud moaning cry, kind of like the siren on the volunteer fire department. It would stretch out for a long time and then end with a whoop-whoop sound. It was coming from the woods opposite the house. His wife asked, "What the hell is that?" John answered truthfully, "That is Tim's cowman." He then described to her the full details of what had happened, and she immediately wanted to call the sheriff. He persuaded her that they would sound crazy and that he would handle it himself. She reluctantly agreed and told him she didn't want either of the kids to go outside until this thing was gone. The howling went on until around midnight, when it got quiet again. John wanted to stay up through the night and watch over the house, but he had a long day at work and the excitement earlier had worn him out. They went to bed around 1 a.m. and had no further problems that night. They slept in that morning and the boys were already up and watching cartoons when they got out of bed. The first thing little John said was that he had heard the bear rubbing against the house last night. He said he was too scared to get up and tell his parents and fell back asleep soon after. Then Tim said, "The cowman talks funny." This stopped John cold. He asked his son, "When did you talk to the cowman?" Tim replied, "Last night, in my room." John asked, "The cowman was in your room?" "No, Daddy. He's too big for my room. He talked to my window," Tim said, and turned back to the cartoons. "What did the cowman say, Tim?" John asked. "He talks funny. I don't know what he said. He talks like this. Ooh, ah, ah, ooh," Tim said, and started making strange monkey-like noises. "Did the cowman try to get into your window?" John asked, breaking out in a cold sweat. "He's too big for that. He made funny faces. He has Lincoln log teeth," Tim said with a smile. John later learned that Tim meant it had square teeth that looked the same size as the small blocks in a Lincoln log set. It apparently spent quite a while talking and making faces outside the boys' window. Tim said it lay down and went to sleep outside, and he could hear it snoring. John walked to his younger son's room and cautiously peered out the window. No sleeping cowman. John told the boys to get dressed. They were going to go visit their uncle in Elma for the day. After his wife and kids left, he called one of the men from his crew and asked him to come over. "I'll call him Patrick. He was an ex-state patrolman, and my dad said he was kicked off the force because of his drinking problem. He was a good worker and never got drunk before dark, so John figured they would have most of the day to look for this thing." When Patrick arrived, John greeted him at the door and said, "Are you up for some hunting?" Seeing how it was not hunting season, Patrick told him he doesn't poach and doesn't even want to know about it, if John did. John told him it wasn't deer he was after, and went on to explain the previous night's events. Patrick didn't really believe him, but could see he was sincere and still shook up. John had his pistol and a bolt-action .30-06. Patrick had a .38 in his car, and John loaned him a 12-gauge. They first circled the house looking for any signs of a nocturnal visitor. At the back of the house, there was a spigot for the garden hose, and it always leaked. There was a patch of ground worn bare of grass, and under it, it had turned to mud. In the center of the mud, there was a huge, clear imprint of what looked like a bare human foot. John said it was at least 18 inches long and very wide. It was so clear that he got the feeling it was left there on purpose. They found no other prints around the house, and in places in the field and woods where a track could be made, the creature seemed to avoid them. Off to the side of the track, in the mud, were four straight lines about 8 inches long. He said it looked like someone had raked their fingers through the mud. When they circled around the side of the house and got to Tim's window, they saw what it was for. Above the top of the window, a good 7 feet up, were four muddy streaks, and on the window itself were dozens of large, muddy fingerprints. The glass wasn't cracked or broken, just smeared with mud. By this time, Patrick was fast becoming convinced something strange had indeed happened the night before. Before going out into the woods, John wanted to feed the family's pigs. They had two of them, apparently fairly young, weighing around 40 pounds each. The pig pen was about 100 yards away from the house, behind an old barn. As they got closer, John became concerned because they couldn't hear them making any noise. Usually they squealed like crazy when they knew food was near at hand, but this morning it was completely silent. They rounded the corner and the pen was empty. No sign of damage or struggle. The pigs were just gone. They searched the barn but found nothing out of place, so they decided to hit the woods and try to kill this thing. They entered on the same trail John and John had used the day before. John showed Patrick the broken fence wire and told him again about the hare. It was a bright summer morning, and John was surprised at the difference from the previous evening. The night before had been still and silent. Now the woods were alive with birds and small animals. He showed Patrick the broken tree, and they followed the creature's trail and found several more trees and large branches twisted and broken. They could see large, faint impressions of footprints where the ground was soft. They followed the deer trail further into the woods and encountered nothing unusual. By noon, they were both getting hungry, so they hiked back to the house for lunch. They spent the rest of the day poking around, but saw nothing more out of the ordinary. Just before dark that night, his wife and kids drove up. He and Patrick were sitting on the porch with the guns, watching the woods. His wife asked if they had seen anything. John told her about the footprint and the mud on the window. Patrick had retrieved a pint of booze from his car and was well on his way to getting smashed. John decided he didn't want a frightened drunk with a gun around his family, so he suggested that Patrick could go home. Nothing was going to happen anyway. Patrick agreed and drove off, and John continued to watch the woods. His wife brought out a plate of food and a Coleman lantern and a flashlight. He told her he would stay out here and watch the house through the night. Before they went to bed, he went into their bedroom and, with the help from his wife, pushed the king-size bed as far from the windows as they could. They agreed that his wife and kids would all sleep in that bed for the night, and he would keep watch around the house. She had grown up hunting and knew how to handle a gun as good as him, so she insisted on keeping the shotgun in the room with them. He agreed after making her promise to ask for a name before shooting anything. If it replied John, please don't shoot it. There was a full moon that night, and John could see across the field and into the inky darkness of the woods. The night air was filled with the sound of 1,000 crickets, and the pond behind the house was full of croaking frogs. As the moon rose higher, clumps of weeds in the field began casting sinister shadows, and before long John was seeing big hairy creatures sneaking up on him in each of them. He stood up and lit a cigarette, trying to shake the fear and concentrate on the task at hand. As he smoked, he wandered to the end of the porch and stood looking at the darkened barn. Something was different, but he couldn't quite place it. The front of the barn facing the house was open, and the moonlight was hitting it from the side, casting the interior in deep shadows. He stood watching the black opening as he finished his smoke, thinking about the missing pigs. He then realized what was wrong. All the crickets and frogs had gone silent. It was quiet as the inside of a mausoleum at night. He could hear the minute shrill buzz of his own nervous system. As he turned to walk back to his chair, he thought he saw movement in the barn. He looked intently at the opening and could make out nothing. Then he turned his head a bit to the side and saw what looked like two red eyes hovering about 8 feet off of the ground. He couldn't see them if he looked straight at them, but when he averted his eyes a little, they became clearer. They were a deep, burning, coal red, almost invisible in the dark. Every few seconds they would disappear when the creature blinked. His heart began thudding in his chest, and he waited for it to leave the barn and approach the house. He slowly backed up to his chair, never looking away, and picked up his .30-06. He walked back to the end of the porch and watched and waited. He stood looking at the blinking red eyes for what seemed like hours, and then the eyes blinked out and never came back. He watched intently but could see no movement. He thought for a moment, then grabbed the flashlight and shined it at the barn. The flashlight was too small to penetrate the darkness of the barn from this distance. He had to get closer. He was none too keen about leaving the relative safety of the porch and confronting a glowing-eyed monster in his barn, but he was damned if he was going to live in fear in his own house. He left the porch and began slowly working his way towards the barn, taking his time, building his courage up. He got closer and still could see no movement. It had gone further into the dark. He got within 20 feet of the opening, and his flashlight would now penetrate the gloom in the barn. He moved the feeble beam of the light over the contents of the barn, an old tractor, an old pickup, boxes and buckets. Too many places for something to hide, even something big. He cautiously walked closer, now shining the flashlight down the barrel of his rifle. He stopped at the entrance and shined the light all over, searching the corners and under the vehicles. He stepped into the barn, every sense straining for sound or movement. He walked around the pickup, tensing for a huge, hairy arm to reach out and grab him at any second. He made his way clear to the rear of the barn without seeing anything, and slowly turned around to leave. He felt both relieved not to have encountered it in the dark barn, and frightened and somewhat confused about where it could have gone. As he was walking out, he glanced at the wide stairs leading up to the hayloft and froze. He knew with complete certainty that it had climbed those stairs and was waiting for him to walk out under the hayloft and jump down upon him. He couldn't move. He was literally frozen in fear. He swore he could hear the floorboards softly creak above him as an enormous weight edged stealthily closer to the edge. He stood with his heart pounding in his ears, unable to move or act. Suddenly, there was a booming explosion of a shotgun from the house, followed by his wife screaming. His paralysis broke, and he bolted out of the barn towards the house, completely forgetting what may have been in the hayloft. As he ran toward the house, he heard an inhuman roar coming from the woods behind the house. It sounded pissed off and in pain. It screamed again, and he heard branches breaking as it plowed through the forest, thankfully away from the house. He got to the house and almost knocked down the front door in his hurry to get inside. He ran down the hall to their room and found his family huddled together on the bed, sobbing. One of the windows was blown out, and his wife was still pointing the shotgun at it. When he burst into the room, she swung the gun in his direction and screamed, and he hit the floor. He waited for the blast, but it didn't come. He slowly stood up, and she had put the gun down and went to the bed. He asked her what had happened, but she was too shook up to answer just then. Tim started crying. "Why did you shoot the cowman, Mommy? Why?" John Jr. had his face buried against her shoulder, crying. After they calmed down a bit, he told them to get up and follow him. He led them to the living room and then went out the open front door and looked carefully around. He could see no sign of it. All was quiet again. He told them to come out and get in the car.
They ran out in their pajamas and piled in the car. He got in and drove them to his brother's house in Elma. On the way there, they had calmed down enough to tell him what had happened. She said a couple of hours after they went to bed, she finally dozed off. She was awakened by Tim talking to someone and this bizarre clicking, chirping sound. Tim wasn't in the bed. He was standing in front of one of the windows. The moonlight was shining through both windows, illuminating the room pretty good, but there was a large shadow, like a tree, obscuring the window in front of Tim. She knew there were no trees close enough to cast a shadow. She told him to get away from the window. "Mommy, listen. The cowman can sound like a bird," Tim said, pointing excitedly at the dark figure in the window. "Timmy, get away from the window," she said, trying to keep her voice quiet. Right after she spoke, the noises from outside changed. It went from a soft chirping to a strange gibbering, almost like human speech with an occasional pig-like snort thrown in. At this time, Little John woke up and said, "What is that?" rather loudly. This seemed to incite the creature, and it hit the side of the house with its fists hard enough for the walls to tremble. At this, Little John screamed, and Tim yelled, "Quiet, you're going to scare him away." She yelled at Tim to get away from the window and reached up to the headboard and grabbed the shotgun. She got out of the bed and started towards Tim. The creature leaned down and looked straight in the window at her. She screamed and raised the shotgun, afraid to shoot because her son was so close to it. She started forward to grab Tim, and there was an explosion of breaking glass. A gigantic, hairy arm reached through the window toward her son. She screamed again and fired over Tim's head, blowing out the rest of the window and hitting the creature with the double-aught buckshot. It jerked backwards out of the window and disappeared into the dark. A few seconds later, she heard it screaming in the woods. It was trying to get Tim. It was trying to get my baby. She started crying again, and he comforted her as best he could while driving. They stayed the rest of that night and the following night with his brother's family. He told his brother about it, but could see he didn't really believe him. He agreed to ride back to John's house with him early Monday morning before work. They had left the front door open in their haste to leave, and he was afraid animals or vandals would have gotten into the house. When they arrived, the house looked like a tornado had gone through it. The couch was upside down. They had a large, heavy console TV, and it was apparently thrown across the room, lying in a spray of broken glass. The kitchen was trashed, the refrigerator knocked over, and food everywhere. The doors to both of the boys' rooms were left closed, and the rooms were untouched, same as the bathroom. The master bedroom was torn apart, the pillows ripped up and feathers everywhere. The chest of drawers was knocked over and the large mirror smashed. John's brother looked around in awe and said, "You better call the police." John looked at him and said, "And tell them what? Bigfoot destroyed my house?" They left and closed the front door this time and drove to my dad's mill in Aberdeen. John's brother waited in the car while John went in and told this to my dad. After he was done, my dad said, "Well, let's go have a look at it then." They drove back out to the house and John showed my dad the damage. He pulled the clump of hair from his shirt pocket and let my dad look at it. As they were walking through the house surveying the damage, my dad pointed out cracks in the ceiling where it had apparently stood up and hit its head. John told my dad that they couldn't live there anymore, even if the creature was gone. They would always be afraid. Their homeowner's insurance wouldn't cover the damage. The adjuster claimed John must have done it in a drunken rage. My dad helped them find a place in Aberdeen and gave him a loan for new furniture and stuff. The house was eventually fixed up and sold, and my dad never heard about another problem there. A few observations about this story. My dad lost contact with John and his family in the mid-80s. They moved out of state, and my dad hasn't heard from them since. His brother died around the same time. Why didn't they call the cops? John had a lot of pride as well as a lot of common sense. He knew he couldn't logically explain what had happened to the authorities, and he didn't want the story to get out and to have him branded as a nutcase. I asked my dad if they saved the hair. He said John never mentioned it again, and my dad never asked him about it. I asked my dad if he saw the footprint and the muddy fingerprints. He said he did. He said it looked like a giant barefoot man had stepped very carefully in the center of the mud. He's not a tracker, but he said it was the clearest print of any kind he had ever seen. I asked my dad if the neighbors had heard any of this. He said if they did, none of them ever mentioned it again. I also asked him if he thought it was possible John had made it all up. That he had trashed his house in a drunken rage and made up this elaborate cover story. My dad said John and his family were terrified of that place. They didn't even want to go back and get their clothes. If it was just an elaborate story, what did he stand to gain? To profit from a story in any way, you have to share it with people. My dad and the other folks mentioned in the story are the only ones who ever heard it. Until now, of course. He also said that whatever trashed that house was no man. The TV had to weigh close to 200 pounds, and it was obviously thrown across the room with great force. He said that even after 2 days, there was still a wild animal smell in the house. I asked him if he thought there might have been two creatures involved, considering the incident in the barn. He said he asked John that same question and was told that John felt there was only one and that it lured him into the barn, then snuck out of the side door to the house. The thing he thought he heard in the hayloft was either his imagination or some common animal like a raccoon. For whatever reason, this critter seemed to focus on their 4-year-old son. Their son was the only one who never showed any fear of it. He seemed to think of it as his friend. And although the sex of the animal was never determined, it was referred to as a male because of the predatory stalking-type behavior. That and the conspicuous lack of breasts, or perhaps it was just not as well endowed as the Patterson film subject. Anyhow, its behavior seems almost indicative of a mother that had lost her little Bigfoot and is looking for a replacement. I rather facetiously asked my dad if little Timmy was a particularly hairy child, perhaps suffering from that rare condition that causes uncontrollable hair growth all over the body. He said Timmy was a normal little boy with normal brown hair on his normal head. I didn't ask if Timmy regularly reeked of rotting garbage and wet dogs. Didn't seem a polite course for the conversation to take. He told me of other possible Bigfoot encounters he and his crews had in the woods around Gray's Harbor. None of them were quite as titillating as the cowman story, but interesting nonetheless. Perhaps I'll share them if there is an interest here in them. So in the end, I was left with no leads to follow, no new evidence of anything, but I did come away with a pretty damn good story. And I guess that's better than a poke in the eye with a filthy, encrusted hypodermic needle. Those of you who actually read this far, I give you a big thumbs up. You are truly an ardent and stoic follower of all things Bigfoot. Or like me, recently underemployed and in desperate need to fill the endless, empty hours of your life. What a story. If this is true, it's one of the most hair-raising cases of a Bigfoot harassing a family on record. But is the story of the cowman really true, or is it a nice work of fiction crafted by a writer trying to fill time? In order to decide, I'll present the pros and the cons. Is it fact, or is it fiction? first, let's discuss the cons. First and foremost, this is a third-hand story. Baker is retelling a story told to him by his dad, who got the story from yet another guy, the co-worker named John. And John isn't even the guy's real name. Baker states that he chose to call the man John for the story, spelling it J-O-N. We can only assume that Baker's father told him the man's real name, but Baker felt it was best to give him an alias since he was not necessarily authorized to publicize the story. So it's impossible to track down the original witness or his family to corroborate the story without the help of Baker. Second-hand and third-hand stories are the least credible in this sort of research, although when it comes to many of the older reports, there may not be any other way to document them since the principal players may have passed on or were not willing to share the details with the world themselves. Back in the 1960s, most people who encountered something like this did not run to the newspaper to report what had happened, and they didn't have the internet to publicize it for themselves. So this doesn't necessarily discredit the story. It just makes it impossible to verify so many years later unless Baker can be tracked down first. Another problem I find with a story is how much specific detail it offers. Usually when someone is retelling a story told by another person who got it from yet another person, it is usually pared down to the essentials. The fact that Baker has so many details gives me the impression that it's either outright fiction or Baker at least added some flourishes in order to fill the gaps, so to speak. Baker's writing is very good, using descriptive adjectives and dynamic prose, so I suspect this isn't the first time he's written or told a story. Perhaps he's even done some professional writing. The grammar and punctuation are pretty good, and aside from the continued use of run-on sentences, I only noticed a few incorrect words, so it's not the usual sort of quick report typed up and sent to a Bigfoot website. That might point to it being fiction, but on the other hand, it might just be that Baker has some writing skills and that is one reason he sat down to recount the story in his own words. The final paragraph is something I've contemplated for a while. It almost seems like Baker is dropping a clue that the story is a work of fiction. He writes, "So in the end, I was left with no leads to follow, no new evidence of anything, but I did come away with a pretty damn good story. And I guess that's better than a poke in the eye with a filthy encrusted hypodermic needle. Those of you who actually read this far, I give you a big thumbs up. You are truly an ardent and stoic follower of all things Bigfoot. Or like me, recently underemployed and in desperate need to fill the endless empty hours of your life." Now, is he implying that devoted Bigfoot enthusiasts have too much time on their hands and are desperate to believe anything? Or is he simply stating that he's had extra time on his hands lately in which he could document the story? And why the comparison to a filthy encrusted hypodermic needle? That seems like an odd and kind of gruesome thing to add if one is trying to document a historical account, even if it does involve something that most people might consider a fringe topic. This line seems out of place with the rest of the tone, but then again, maybe I'm reading too much into it. At the end, Baker says he has no more leads to follow, so he sort of seals up the case and leaves it at that. As I mentioned at the beginning, I'm not sure if Bobby ever followed up or corresponded with Baker, so we have no further info about the cowman incident, only what Baker provides in his story. To that end, I attempted to find out if anyone in the area had heard of the cowman story prior to 1995, which is the earliest year it could have been posted on Bigfoot Encounters. Jason Burke, whom I met several years ago in Washington State, and the one who first suggested I cover the cowman story, has been very helpful in my research on it. Jason lived in Copalis Beach for a few years, so he's got some connections. Jason reached out to some friends in the area and did some other inquiries trying to determine if anyone around there had ever heard of the cowman story prior to 1995. Unfortunately, he could not find anyone that had. I was traveling recently and coincidentally ran across a Bigfoot enthusiast who had lived in the Copalis Beach area. He had never heard of the story, and when he asked a few friends who lived there now, they had not heard of the story either, at least outside of the Bigfoot Encounters website version. This doesn't rule it out as being untrue, of course. Baker noted that John was reluctant to tell his family's story because he didn't want to be labeled a nutcase, so perhaps he didn't tell many people and it just drifted into the past. The story shares some similarities with the famous Ford incident from 1971 in Boggy Creek, which I've covered in past episodes, with the creature stalking around the house on multiple occasions and its aggressive nature. But this goes further, with the creature allegedly communicating with a young boy and then trashing the house. It shares even more similarities with the classic Bigfoot case known as the Ruby Creek incident. The story of Ruby Creek was first published in 1960 by Ivan T. Sanderson, one of the first researchers in cryptozoology. In this case, Sanderson interviewed a First Nations family by the name of Chapman in British Columbia, who claimed a Sasquatch had come to their house for many nights in a row. It's a long story and one I might cover on a later episode, but for our purposes here, Jason and I noted the similarities with repeated visits to the home, approaching kids, destroying parts of the home, and get this, in the Ruby Creek case, when the creature was first sighted by her eldest son, Miss Chapman said he ran in and said, quote, "A cow was coming out of the woods. It was coming towards the house." That was the only thing he could compare it to. It turned out to be a 7.5-foot Sasquatch, very similar to the Copalis Beach story, which is pretty interesting. The similarities between these two classic Bigfoot stories may be coincidental, but cannot be overlooked when evaluating the validity of Baker's story. In the end, I couldn't find any evidence of the Cowman of Copalis Beach story having been mentioned anywhere prior to 1995, so we are left with the only source of this particular story being the 6,193 words written by Shannon Baker, or S.D. Baker, as his email account says. Perhaps he knows a man named D.B. Cooper. Alright, now to the positives which may support the story as being true. The Bigfoot in this story is very aggressive, which adds to the tension of the tale, but might seem a bit over the top. However, it's not out of the realm of what some people have reported. As I mentioned, this has some similarities to the actions of the Boggy Creek monster at the Ford House and the Ruby Creek incident, which were both very credible reports, and to other cases which I've covered in my Bigfoot Attacks episode of this very podcast. While I do find that the majority of the aggressive Bigfoot accounts do come from the southern United States, there are some that take place in the north, even in the Pacific Northwest. Native tribes of that region often feared what they referred to as hairy giants or forest people, claiming they would kidnap women or children. In 1924, a group of prospectors were assaulted by what they said were some kind of upright, hair-covered creatures over the course of one terrifying night while mining at a place known as Ape Canyon in Mount St. Helens, Washington. A man named Albert Ostman claimed he was dragged through the forest in a sleeping bag by a huge Bigfoot-like creature that very same year near Toba Inlet, British Columbia. According to a newspaper article, a gorilla-like thing attacked two men who were cutting timber near Rome, Ohio in 1897. They had to struggle to fight it off, They described it as being about 6 feet tall, covered in hair, and able to walk upright. And there are plenty of other cases which suggest that on some occasions, these creatures may act aggressively and maybe even kill people. So what we have with the cowman is not totally far-fetched. The characteristics of the red glowing eyes, the human-like footprints measuring 18 inches long, the hair that resembled a horse's mane, the Lincoln log teeth, and the ability to run very fast on two legs are all within the reported characteristics of a Bigfoot. Even the details about the primitive voice communication and bird chirping or whistling match other alleged Bigfoot behavior. So nothing about these details seems out of the ordinary. Of course, this sort of information would have been available to Baker when he sent in the story, but at least there's no red flags or far-fetched actions within these details. I think the best support for the cowman story comes from the location itself. Copalis Beach is located within Grays Harbor County, Washington, where some very credible and very unexplainable encounters with upright, hair-covered creatures have been reported. In fact, some of the best Bigfoot reports and footprint casts have originated from this very county. For example, on August 7, 1969, the same decade in which the cowman story is said to have taken place, a Grays Harbor County deputy sheriff who lived in Copalis Beach was driving home from a late-night call when he came upon a tall, hairy animal standing on two legs in the road. He stopped his vehicle and observed it from a distance of about 75 feet for nearly 2 minutes. The deputy, Verlin Harrington, said the beast was at least 7 feet tall and probably weighed over 300 pounds. He said it was completely covered in hair and had a leathery-looking face. It did not have a snout and was definitely not a bear. The incident was initially publicized by the newspaper as a Sasquatch sighting, but after the department was inundated with calls, the sheriff backtracked, telling the media that his deputy had merely seen a bear walking upright. Journalist and Sasquatch researcher John Green, whose books are among the most important documents in terms of Bigfoot history, interviewed Harrington a short time after his sighting. The transcript of the interview is included in Green's Sasquatch: The Apes Among Us book from 1976. The interview itself tells the story best.
To begin with, could we get your name on tape?
My name is Verlin Harrington.
Where do you live?
I live at Copalis Beach, Washington.
How old are you?
I'm 30 years old.
What is your occupation?
I'm a deputy sheriff for Grays Harbor County.
Now, the incident we've been discussing, could you give us the date when it took place?
Yes, it was July 26th. It was on a Sunday.
And the year?
1969.
And what time?
It was 2:35 a.m.
What were you doing at the time?
I had been on an incident in Hump Tulips, and I was en route by way of DK Road, by Grass Creek Road, to the beach and into my residence.
What was it that happened while you were making the trip?
As I was going down DK Road, I rounded a corner, and my first impression was of a large bear standing in the middle of the road. I either had to stop for the bear or hit him, so I decided to stop, slammed on the brakes, and came to a screeching halt. I coasted up the slight grade as far as I could without startling the animal as I was going towards it. This animal, in my opinion, was not a bear because you could see by the way it was standing that it had no snout. It had a face on it. Its eyes reflected, and when it came to a complete stop, I could see in the headlights of my car that it had feet on it instead of paws, and it had breasts. When I centered my spotlight on the patrol car on it, it walked to the edge of the road. It didn't fall down on all fours like a bear would. It walked upright as a person would. Its feet had hair down to the soles, but you could see the outline of the foot. It did have toes. Its hand was in a position where it was spread out, and it did have fingers. After I'd readjusted the spotlight, I rolled the window down, pulled my revolver, and crawled out of the car. I aimed my revolver at it, and as I cocked the hammer on it, the animal went into the brush. I got back in my car and drove off. I reported the next morning back to the scene and went through the area where the animal had gone into the bush and where it had come back out onto the roadway.
Did you find any tracks?
Yes, I found one indention on the ground. I did take a photograph of it. It wasn't such a print that you could pour a cast of.
How big was it?
I measured the track. It was around 18 and a half inches. The animal itself was around 7 to 7.5 feet tall, weighing approximately 300 to 325 pounds.
How far away were you when you were looking at it?
75 to 80 feet.
How long would you say you were able to observe it before it left the road?
Approximately a minute, minute and a quarter, maybe a minute and a half. This was from the time that I came to a complete stop. I was observing it as I coasted towards it, so maybe overall 2 minutes.
And in that time, it was standing erect on its hind legs?
Yes, it was. As it went off into the brush, it was still on its hind legs.
Can you tell us anything about the shape of the head? For instance, your first impression was a bear. Did it have a snout?
No, it didn't have a snout. I couldn't say that it had a nose like a person would have. I believe there was hair on its face. It had a dark, leathery look.
Did you get any impression about the length of the hair on the head or on the rest of it?
I would say about 3 to 4 inches on the head.
It didn't have long hanging hair at all?
Longer on the head than the body, yes.
Could you tell how long the arms were?
I would have to guess at how long they were. The arm that I was looking at was in a bent position, like you catch someone startled.
Comparing it to a human, would you say that it had long legs or short legs?
Long legs. I would say long, muscular legs.
Did it take long strides?
They would be large steps for a normal human, but for this animal, they were short steps. About 3 steps from the center of the road to the edge.
Did you notice any difference in the way it walked and the way a human would walk?
Same type of position, same type of walk as a human being.
Did it have a narrow waist?
It was a big body, a big stout body. That's the best I remember it was. It could have been thinner at the waist, I don't remember.
It was pretty heavily built.
Yes.
This is obviously a very credible individual, and his sighting was only a few miles east of Copalis Beach. My colleague, Daniel Perez, who publishes the Bigfoot Times monthly newsletter and has the most extensive library of Bigfoot-related files, told me a friend of his visited Harrington in 1996, and the ex-law officer, who was actually eventually let go from the sheriff's department for publicizing his report, confirmed that the incident definitely happened. A year after the Harrington encounter, 3 girls claimed a hairy 7-foot-tall creature jumped into the roadway while they were driving between Copalis Crossing and Carlisle. One of the girls' father was Russell Figg, who also happened to be a deputy sheriff in Grays Harbor County. He did an unofficial investigation of the area where he found footprints measuring 16 inches in length. John Green also investigated the sighting, visiting the scene and interviewing the witnesses himself. A few years later, in 1972, 2 teenage boys were walking home from an evening baseball game in Grays Harbor, only 50 miles east of Copalis, when they were chased by an 8-foot ape-like creature. The boys, Kirk and Kelly, told Sasquatch researcher Dr. Henner Fehrenbach they were walking along a rural road to their house at about 1 a.m. when they heard noises behind them. When they turned around, they could see a dark figure standing beside the road. When the figure began to follow them, they became frightened and took off running. The thing pursued them, seemingly walking with long strides that easily paced their running. When they reached the first and only neighbor's house before their own, they jumped over a picket fence and ran to the door where they started pounding furiously. The woman recognized the boys as her neighbors and opened up the door. The boys told her some kind of monstrous thing was chasing them, to which she assured them there are no monsters. But when she stepped outside and looked in the yard, however, she screamed, "Good God, there it is!" The Sasquatch had by then stepped over the fence and was standing in the yard. She immediately pulled the boys inside and slammed the door. The three of them then observed it from a small window by the door. By this time, it was standing about 12 feet from the porch. By their estimation, the creature was around 8 feet tall, with grayish-brown hair about 3 to 6 inches long covering the body and most of the face. It had a flat nose, long arms, wide shoulders, narrow hips, and long legs. The creature remained in the yard for several moments, just peering at the house. Then it turned and stepped over the fence and walked across the street. The woman and the boys cracked open the front door again to observe it as it walked down an embankment towards a nearby river, where it went out of sight. The boys eventually recovered from the terror and walked the remaining 400 yards home with borrowed flashlights. In the morning, a man who lived nearby found footprints measuring 17 inches long. He followed them down to the river, where they ended at the water. The creature in this case appeared to be stalking the young men, which is similar to some of the behavior detailed in the cowman story. I suppose they were lucky it did not pursue them into the woman's house. The location of Copalis Beach is south of the Olympic National Forest, where a group of large entities such as Sasquatch could certainly live in relative remoteness. Perhaps in these cases, the creatures traveled south along the coast, where they were then seen by the various locals. Copalis Beach is also directly south of the vast and mysterious Quinault Indian Reservation. According to the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, BFRO, website, the areas around the perimeter of the reservation have among the highest quantity of credible Sasquatch sightings on the North American continent. Their database doesn't necessarily reflect this, however, because their policy is only to post sightings that have been submitted in writing, online, or by the witnesses themselves. Many people living on the reservation do not have computers or internet access, so those kind of sightings may have only been reported by word of mouth to investigators in the area. Most of the Quinault Indian Reservation is completely unpopulated because nearly all of the tribal members, perhaps 1,500 in all, live in three small villages on the perimeter of the reservation. There are no villages in the interior. Some logging crews do work in the interior by day, but do not remain there at night. With the abundance of protein sources such as elk, deer, and salmon, and the lush vegetation and water sources, it could potentially host a substantial amount of these mysterious creatures, and we would never know. In terms of the amount of credible activity in Grays Harbor, we certainly can't overlook the amazing tracks found there in 1982. The tracks, known to the Bigfoot world as the Grays Harbor or Hereford tracks, are a fascinating case unto themselves. The tracks were found in four locations around the towns of Elma, Brady, and Matlock, not far from Copalis Beach, during the months of April and May in 1982. The first set of tracks were reported on April 22, 1982, by a resident living near a place known as Abbott Hill in eastern Grays Harbor County. The resident contacted Deputy Sheriff Dennis Hereford, who responded to the call. When Hereford arrived on the scene, he was escorted to a secluded spot on private land among some heavy timberlands. There he was shown what appeared to be two large footprints with human-like features along the base of a fire trail. They were approximately 46 inches apart, and the toes of each track pointed in the same direction. The deputy photographed both tracks and made a plaster cast of the left foot. The tracks measured 15.5 inches long. More tracks were found approximately a quarter mile from the first set of tracks. They were also photographed and measured. Shortly thereafter, Deputy Hereford was informed of similar tracks located 7 miles west along the Satsop River at a place called Warman's Bar. Upon investigation, Hereford found 2 separate sets of tracks together. The largest was 17 inches long. The smallest was 15 and a half inches long. Hereford was intrigued because not only were the footprints large, no 2 of them were exactly alike. They appeared to have been made by the same or similar individuals, yet each foot showed variations consistent with a real flesh footpad, not a stamp or a mold. In other words, these looked like very real footprints made by something physically walking in these areas. On April 27th, Hereford was informed by Officer Jim Young of the Oakville Police Department that numerous tracks had been discovered along the Chehalis River in an area known as Elmagate Boat Launch. Deputy Hereford and Sergeant Beryl Hutchinson went to the location where they processed the scene as Hereford had done before. They cast 1 of the left foot tracks. A month later, on May 23rd, Hereford was contacted yet again, this time by a pastor of a local church who found some large tracks in a fairly secluded area of Capitol Forest. Hereford went to the location where he observed 4 tracks similar to the ones he had seen previously. He processed the scene, casting 2 of these tracks. The resulting track castings, photos, and information seem very credible given the meticulous investigation by a law enforcement officer. And they are some of the best examples of alleged Sasquatch tracks ever cast. Just Google Gray's Harbor Bigfoot tracks if you want to take a look at them. Deputy Hereford later wrote up a detailed summary of the events surrounding the track investigations. He stated that, of the sightings investigated, no 2 tracks were of the same measurements. The largest distance between the sightings was between Elmagate and Abbott Hill, approximately 9 miles. All the sightings indicated something of great weight, with steps varying from 32 inches between to 59 inches between. At the Porter Creek and Elmagate scenes, there was evidence of obvious foraging. At all the scenes, there was evidence of great height and weight, and a lack of tracks to indicate that the evidence was placed there as a hoax. So in terms of documented sightings and possible evidence of Bigfoot, Grays Harbor County, Washington is rather exceptional. And that, perhaps, lends credibility to the Cowman of Copalis Beach story. In 2015, my friend and fellow Texan, David Ford, wrote, co-directed, and starred in a movie titled Something in the Woods. The movie was inspired by the Cowman of Copalis Beach story and is essentially an adaptation following most of the details. The movie was shot in East Texas, which also has a long history of Bigfoot sightings. So we have a situation where art is imitating life, or perhaps vice versa, depending on the truth behind Baker's story. David told me that sometime after the release of the film, he was contacted by someone claiming to be Baker, demanding money. When David suggested they work it out in court, he never heard from the man again. Along these lines, a man once posted on the long-running Bigfoot Forums website that he was actually the author. But that claim also remains unconfirmed. Either way, I think the film is one of the best Bigfoot movies I've seen, and being set in the 1960s, it kind of has a Legend of Boggy Creek vibe. The term Cowman is certainly unique in terms of a regional Bigfoot name, but it's not the only time that moniker has been given to a scary cryptid. According to author Mark Opsasnik, The term cowman was used in Dorchester County, Maryland during the 1800s. The cowman in this case was said to be a manimal who attacked livestock. Theories suggested it was in actuality a feral human. But either way, it's interesting that the cowman name had been used before. The area of Copalis Beach has remained much the way it was back in the 1960s, very rural and not as developed as many other coastal places. And Grays Harbor County still logs sightings of strange hairy things. In the summer of 2008, a U.S. postal carrier for the remote town of Quinault Lake was making his rounds when he saw something he cannot explain. As he rounded a corner, he spotted a large hairy animal standing on two legs about an eighth of a mile ahead. He first took it to be a bear, but as it continued to walk upright across the road, he could see it was something quite different. He drove towards it and got within 30 yards before it stepped off to the side of the gravel shoulder and disappeared into the brush.
I was approximately 30 yards or so away. I really don't know for sure what I witnessed, but I will say this. I've seen bear, elk, deer, all kinds of wildlife around this area. I drive it daily. This was not bear, elk, deer, or anything else. Whatever this was, I had never seen before, and it was big.
The truth behind the story of the cowman of Copalis Beach may never be known, but in a pursuit where sightings of this nature and even alleged attacks by unexplained beasts are recounted by people whom we can and do interview and scrutinize, it doesn't seem out of place. And if it is merely fiction, then it has done well to inspire curiosity, wonder, movies, and even a healthy fear of what may still be lurking out there on the fringes of our society. Just take a hike into the forests of the Olympic Peninsula and spend the night on a lonely ridge along the coast. You just might see a pair of glowing red eyes peering at you from the darkest depths of the realm I call Monstro Bizarro. Special thanks to Jason Burke for his assistance on this episode. If you have a suggestion for a topic or a question, please drop by LyleBlackburn.com and hit the podcast link.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.